Welcome back into another episode of Peter's Proffer here in the courtroom of current events. Last week we had some Point Break talk, and this week we get a few good men with our real life version of Lieutenant Daniel Caffey, Tom Cruise's character in A Few Good Men. We have a former JAG officer in the Navy, and he's still currently in the reserves. He's going to tell us about the differences between military law and civilian law. He's going to give us some stories, and he also is a criminal defense lawyer in Key West, specializing in representing tourists and visitors when they come to Key West and get arrested. So, really cool guy with some really cool stories. So, hope you guys are going to enjoy this interview. And as always, leave some reviews, leave some ratings on the podcast. It really helps us out, and we love to hear your feedback. All right, so we are going to talk about military law. And Pete, before we really get started, why don't you introduce our guest more formally?
Sure. Our guest is Alan Fowler. He and I got acquainted and became friends back when we served on the Florida Bar Young Lawyers Board of Governors together. He is a former active duty Naval JAG officer, and his last active duty post was as general counsel for the Naval Station in Key West. He is currently a lieutenant commander in the Navy JAG Corps Reserve, and in his capacity there, he defends sailors that are being discharged from the Navy. On the other side of his life, he actually does have a law practice. It's kind of very interesting. Down in Key West, he represents and defends tourists and vacationers that get accused of crimes while they're partying down in the Keys.
Thanks for being here, Alan. We really appreciate it, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so... And I had Pete do that formal introduction because I definitely would have screwed up some of the military jargon and I didn't want to get any of your titles wrong. It sounds very esteemed and important, so I didn't want to mess any of that up. But I do have to ask, and it's probably something nobody's ever asked you before, have you ever asked the question, did you order the code red?
No, but I have screamed, I want the truth.
There you go. And could you handle it when they gave it to you? I love that movie. It's literally one of my favorite movies ever. And in the intro that you didn't hear, I said we have the real life Lieutenant Caffey coming on. So you've got a big name to live up to as we go through it. So why don't we start out by talking about, give us the difference of what military law is versus civilian law, because you know I don't know much about it. I'm basically a layperson when we talk about military law, but there are a lot of differences that are pretty significant.
Yeah. Which, by the way, just so we don't leave that topic about A Few Good Men, apparently that's based on a true story that happened in Guantanamo Bay.
Correct. That's what I've heard, yeah.
And I heard, you know, Aaron Sorkin, you know, who had great success with other things like West Wing. I guess his sister, if I understand correctly, was a Navy JAG or somehow connected to that.
Yeah, I didn't know that about his sister, but yeah, I knew that he was intimately involved with all of the details of it, too, and... a million things went on within that movie that just kind of added to the legend of that story, too.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And I guess the attorney who Tom Cruise's character is based on is a practicing criminal defense lawyer in Virginia somewhere.
And his dad really was a big shot and things like that, and he was kind of living in his dad's shadow, and all that stuff was real, supposedly.
Yeah, very interesting. It is a pretty good movie. So anyway, we'll get back to it. So the military law, at least in a criminal context, is governed by what we call the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which is a federal law that, of course, is promulgated by U.S. Congress and then, or passed rather by U.S. Congress, and then the president naturally is authorized to promulgate regulations to implement the various, parts of the UCMJ, particularly the procedure, but the Congress, for the most part, drafts criminal provisions. And the idea here, and I think probably the central theme between the distinction of civilian law, as we would call it, and military law, is there's a sense in the military, this sort of common theme, that a commander of a unit has the authority to implement discipline and to take criminal action against one of his or her sailors or Marines or soldiers who commit some kind of misconduct. And that's really I think the why they have their own procedure and why they have their own set of laws is it starts from this premise that the commander owns his people, right? And if, mm-hmm. and if his people get in trouble by, you know, breaking a law that we've decided is a law, that the commander can take action and should take action to preserve good order and discipline and in the interest of justice and whatnot. And I think from that notion, the idea behind the UCMJ also is to embrace the uniqueness and the nuances of military life and military obligations that civilian law just wouldn't cover, right? That's just isn't applicable. For example, as we most of us probably know through, you know, popular culture, in the military, you can't go AWOL, right? You can't just disappear or not show up to work. You know, most commonly, that's prosecuted under a provision called unauthorized absence because it's easier to prove. But but obviously in the civilian world, that's not true, right? If one of our employees doesn't show up to work, we just fire them.
Right.
But in the military, if you abscond, you can be prosecuted.
So when you're talking about the commander owning his platoon or his soldiers, that's kind of has multiple layers to it because, like in A Few Good Men that we keep referencing, something that was really important is did their commanding officer tell them to do something which would absolve them from at least some culpability, but then also secondarily, it's layered in kind of a handling things internally if you can with the commander making certain decisions if his guys do stuff.
Right.
So go ahead.
And the most common and, I guess, illustrative distinction of this is that, in the civilian world, when someone commits a crime that has a victim, you know, like a battery or an assault or something, you know, a person is arrested, they have a criminal case, the prosecutor is assigned to the case, and the prosecutor, you know, naturally will liaise with the victim and obviously take into account the victim's intentions. But for the most part, the prosecutor has authority and autonomy on how they want to resolve the case,
right?
Particularly if the victim was being unreasonable. Well, in the military, when someone is accused of committing a crime, let's say it's the same thing that has a victim, right? So not a victimless crime like possession of drugs where the victim is society at large or something, I guess. But when there's a human being who's identified as a victim, in the military, you know, they have prosecution units. You know, they have, you know, attorneys that are prosecutors, of course. But in the military, what happens is the commander of the defendant convenes the court-martial, directs the court-martial, and the prosecutor is assigned to the case, and the prosecutor has to confer with the commander, and that commander has to consent for plea agreements.
So you're saying in addition to having a judge, it has to go through the commander as well?
Right. Okay. So for example, if I was a defense attorney negotiating with a military prosecutor, I made a plea offer, that prosecutor cannot accept or decline on his own.
Hmm.
That prosecutor would have to go to the commander and say, hey, you know, Colonel Sartis, you know, remember, I'm working this case for you. Lieutenant Commander Fowler has offered this. Here's my recommendation. Do you accept? Right? He is, in a sense, the client of the prosecutor, which is quite different from the civilian world.
So he has to consent before the prosecutor even makes that offer to the defendant?
No, you know, you can still exchange offers. I just mean before it's
done,
you have an agreement.
Okay, I got you.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Let me ask Alan, other than us in uniform, is there anybody else that is subject to UCMJ?
You know, that's the updates they made to the UCMJ, you know, I think in part is intended to modernize certain developments. And as I understand it, they've extended jurisdiction to certain civilian contractors who are hired and then I think deployed in combat zones. Which became a common thing, of course, during our conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. But for the most part, unless you're one of these unique subtleties that is you know, where you're really embedded in a criminal unit, it's going to be active duty military or reservists like myself who are engaging in their reserve duties at that particular moment in time or the day, you know, the evenings of their duty.
So how is the process different besides kind of what we've already gotten with the commanding officer? I know obviously the jury pool is different, right? It's not just six people that have a driver's license. What other things are different in the process when somebody how are the arrests made? How's bail, bond, holding them in a facility? You know, how does that work in military law?
Well, it's very complex, only because it's so different from the civilian world. The most obvious difference is that in the civilian world, often people are arrested, you know, almost the, you know, immediately after an incident, right? There's a traffic stop that leads to an arrest. In the military, typically the criminal prosecutions are triggered after there's been some investigation.
Okay.
Now, those investigations are most commonly done by whatever criminal investigative service that branch has. So the Navy, it's, you know, NCIS, as we all know from the TV show.
I'm sure it's exactly like the show, too.
Right. Peter, what do they call it in the Army? I think it's CIS, just Criminal Investigative Service.
Yes.
I think is the term. You know, so they drop the A. But so, you know, commonly they're doing investigations, and then they go to, when they feel like they have enough to bring a case, they will, if they haven't already been working with a prosecutor, they will. And that prosecutor and that agent would go to the commander and say, look, here's what we got on this service member, and here's what we think he did. Like, for example, sexual assault, we think he committed sexual battery, and here's why. And if the commander agrees, then he convenes a court martial, in the sense of it's kind of a weird term, but he refers charges, is the idea. And then so they fill out sort of the top third of a two-page piece of paper, and they serve this document on the accused service member. So you get called to an office, they give you a piece of paper that says, look, you've been accused of this crime or set of crimes, as the case may be. And they read him his rights, and then they give him an opportunity to speak with a lawyer, and most commonly, you know, they elect that right. And then they just have to acknowledge the charges and don't have to plea or anything. And then from there, the case...
Well, let me pause you real quick. So when they get the opportunity to speak with a lawyer, does it have to be a JAG lawyer? Can they get a private civilian lawyer? How does that, is one appointed for them? Is it free? How does that work?
At that point, they're entitled to a free consultation with a active duty JAG. And they certainly, of course, are free to pursue consultations, you know, among civilian JAGs if they'd like.
Okay.
And that process, you know, the one thing that the military really, I think, does pretty well from like a cultural standpoint is to be very protective of the rights of the defendants.
Okay.
In fact, you know, to give you an example, in the military, you know, I keep using the word defendant just because that's how most of us, you know, think of that party. But in the military, they think the word defendant is too pejorative. I mean that sincerely. They think it's too pejorative. It actually paints that person in too negative of a light, so they use the word accused.
Right.
That's the word. I mean, including in the middle of trial, you know, the judge will say, you know, so and so is the accused, not the defendant.
Yeah, we feel that way in civilian criminal defense too. Nobody else seems to care though.
Right. I mean, and that's what you know. And so it seems like the culture, even among prosecutors and commanders, is, hey, this guy has rights, and so we want them to be fully advised of their rights and to invoke their rights.
And I would guess that comes from a mutual respect everybody has for each other, where it's not necessarily shared in civilian life with, you know, some prosecutors and some defendants. They don't necessarily have a lot of respect for them. But in the military, you know, there's probably a more of a baseline of respect to start the process.
Yes. Now, before... You know, I don't think that same level of respect is followed by the investigators, and I think the investigators are hoping they don't invoke their right to remain silent, you know, when they're interrogated. But, you know, once it's clear that we're at a point where this human being is going to be prosecuted, I think it's fair to say that all of the players sincerely, you know, want to make sure that the process is followed properly, both for, you know, so that this person gets the best defense possible, but so that the process itself is the most sound and, you know, methodical that it should be, right? But so, you know, getting back to it, so, you know, what ends up happening is, depending on the nature of the offense, a commander will then, you know, what's called convene either a special court-martial or a general court-martial. And there's some other steps in this process that I'm skipping just because I'd have to give you guys, you know, a lot of background.
We're getting the gist of what's different about it.
Let me jump in for a second. Let me give you something that had happened when I was a young soldier. You can kind of tell us how, I guess, it is different between the military and civilian law when it comes to your rights, for example, that are your constitutional rights. When I was at Fort Leonard, Missouri, like 30 years ago, there was a credit card or like an ATM fraud. Somebody had broken into an ATM and stolen some money. And what wound up happening was, at the time, it was called Criminal Investigation Division, CID, came to our barracks. The battalion commander ordered every soldier out. We were all, you know, standing in parade rest out in front of the in the courtyard, and the CID folks had a picture that the ATM machine had taken, and they literally walked by every single soldier in my battalion, you know, trying to make a facial recognition. Now, is that something, is it different in UCMJ versus civilian life, what your rights are against self-incrimination?
You know, they're, at this point in time, they're more or less aligned. If anything, you have probably a few more protections in the military. In fact, one of the ones that I find most interesting and kind of most proud of is the military's equivalent of Miranda warnings, right? So we all know what Miranda warnings are from watching, you know, cop television shows. Well, most people, like our clients, I'm sure you guys get this a lot, almost everybody's like, hey, you know, a cop did this and he never read me my rights. Well, you know, in the civilian world, they don't have to read your rights until you've been arrested, right, or otherwise in custody where your liberty is restrained akin to an arrest, and then they're asking you questions, you know, that could lead to an incriminating response. And in the military, it's much more broad. For starters, you don't have to be in custody, for starters. So, you know, if someone is called into their commander's office for a suspicion like the one that Peter just described, they're certainly not under arrest, right? If, you know, if somebody walks in and says, hey, sit down, I want to talk to you about this ATM fraud thing that's going on. Not under arrest, not in handcuffs or sitting in a jail cell or something. But if you're going to ask this person questions that may lead to an incriminating response, you know, or, you know, some reasonableness of leading to an incriminating response, you have to read them their rights. And in the military, those rights are codified under Article 31B. We call them Article 31 Bravo warnings. They're basically identical to Miranda warnings, as we all know them. But I find it very interesting, you know, that the military recognizes that, number one, that these formal arrests don't happen as frequently and as commonly as it would in the civilian world. But more importantly, that because of the nature of the military, service members are oftentimes ordered to go meet with people, or they're questioned or have meetings with their supervisors, and they have been trained to be honest, right, and be forthcoming, right. Or at least they have a fear about what to do. So they've said, you know what, because of this dynamic, we're going to say that if someone is asking questions of another person that has a reasonable likelihood of eliciting a incriminating response, we're going to require the questioner to advise them of their rights. Now, that's different than, like, a casual conversation, right? Like, if I'm, you know, if I, you know, I'm a lieutenant commander, if I was, you know, walked up to an enlisted person and said, hey, Peter, what do you do over the weekend? And they said, well, you know, I bought some cocaine, and then I committed adultery. Like, well, you know, obviously when I asked that question, I wasn't trying to elicit an incriminating response. I wasn't, you know, conducting an investigation. But, you know, if I had reason to believe that somebody in my unit is currently on drugs, right, which is a violation of the UCMJ, and I called them into my office, and I was going to ask them questions about whether or not they've been using drugs, well, certainly my intent, my questions are likely to elicitate something that could incriminate themselves, so I had to read them their warnings. So I think that's, you know, that's a good illustration of what I was saying earlier of how, you know, much of the law, much of the system is mindful of how the military is different than normal civilian culture on these topics.
Hey, Alan, let me ask you, just said something that kind of sparked a thought. You used the crime of adultery. And let's talk for a second about the different things that constitute crimes in the military. Because obviously, in civilian life, I'm sure there are still laws on the books on many state at the state level that you know, illegalize, you know, different types of sexual activity. But let's be real, they're not really enforced at all. How does that differ in the military?
And you also earlier mentioned not showing up for work being a criminal act, basically, in the military. So what are some other things like adultery, like not showing up for work, and why are they crimes in the military?
Yeah, well, I would say that the military is still prone to having some articles that, and by articles I mean criminal provisions, that are on the books but just aren't, you know, prosecuted, you know, very often. But they got some that, you know, are still kind of like, you know, pet projects of prosecutors, I'd say. So, you know, for starters, you know, it's like Peter said, we have a lot of, you know, things in the civilian criminal code that that no one ever gets prosecuted for, especially when you think about how most states have the power under some circumstances to criminalize municipal ordinances. You know, like in my hometown of Winter Park, Florida, it's against the law to spit on the sidewalk, right? Under some circumstances. Yeah. Municipal ordinances could be crimes. So, I mean, we're really talking about a huge swath of things that most people have no reason to know could be crimes. Well, in contrast, in the military, we, like I've said a few times, we've got this thing called the Uniform Code of Military Justice, you know, which is reviewed and, you know, from time to time, updated, right? And so I think because of the distinction, you know, where in civilian, you know, legislatures, they just make new laws all the time and hardly ever repeal old ones. We've got a pretty finite set of laws in the military. And when they do update the UCMJ, I think they're oftentimes mindful of what are things that either we can reclassify or just eliminate because they're not necessary, you know, at this point. So, you know, with the example of, you know, missing work, you know, it's a pretty big deal in the military when you, you know, sign up to enlist or to otherwise obligate yourself as an officer. They train you, they outfit you with uniforms, they spend all this money and resources on you. And then for you just to leave and quit, right, you know, is a pretty big deal.
The government doesn't look like when you waste their money.
Been invested in you. But what you also see here is the military's internal unique culture that is springing into action and manifesting in the criminal code, right? You know, in civilian life, if someone, one of our employees was to quit and just disappear, obviously we wouldn't be happy.
Well, that's just because we're wasting our money, not the government's money. When you waste the government's money, it's a much bigger deal than when you just waste our money.
Well, Alan, let me throw in there for a second. And I think a lot of it is the difference in what we do in the military. For example, I know that you know, the laws against adultery are really there not necessarily because the military is so keen on who their soldiers are having, you know, sexual relations with, but because you're working so closely in a unit, and in many instances, for example, me in the Army, people's lives are at stake. You can't have internal squabbles amongst the ranks.
Right.
You can't have that, right, because the unit falls apart and then everybody's safety, life is in danger.
And similarly with people going AWOL, right?
Right. You know, like depending,
it's a
on them.
Big deal in the Navy to commit an offense they call missing ships movement. And, you know, Peter, they probably have a similar thing for missing some kind of deployment or something for the Army. But, like, imagine, you know, you're taking, you know, 300 people out on a boat, And if 10% of them decided they didn't want to show up for a three-month cruise, what that does to the rest of the team, right? And so that's what you're seeing happen is the team culture, the team demands of a military unit, whether it's very small, like a small special forces unit, or very large, like an aircraft carrier, that the team culture triggers a desire for certain accountability in a criminal context, right? And so because of that, like you said, Peter, you know, setting aside, you know, the morality and ethics behind adultery, the big reason why people will be prosecuted for adultery or punished for adultery is, number one, it can destroy the morale of a unit, particularly if the adultery is happening within the unit, and the scuttlebutt, the rumor mill that spreads around, you know, with that. And it might, you know, create ill will if someone thinks that another member is getting special treatment because he or she is sleeping with the commander, or worse, you know, that they're getting worse treatment because they used to sleep with that person. You know, it can have big deals. And again, because of the nature of the military, in contrast to the civilian world, where you could just kind of, people can quit, or you can fire them, you know, subject to, you know, the laws regarding things like that. You can't really do that as easily in the military, right? You can't just say, you know what, I really hate my boss.
Right.
I'm going to leave. You know, you can't. I mean, you're stuck there, or they're stuck there. So,
as Santiago found out, it's hard to transfer from one to the other.
Yeah.
So when you talk about punishments, what are some different kind of punishments you get in the military? I know, obviously, the one that I think of is dishonorably discharged, which is a big deal, and you can explain why, but it's not always just prison time, although I assume there is that in the military for punishments. What are some different kinds of punishments you can get at the end, or dispositions you can get at the end of a criminal prosecution?
Yeah, well, the most common, so you got two types of courts-martial. Actually, there's now four different types of courts-martial, but in a criminal context, the two is a general court-martial and a special court-martial. They're kind of like the difference between misdemeanor and the felony courts.
Okay.
But not exactly like that. But in a special court-martial, they can only issue what's called a bad conduct discharge, and a general court-martial can order a dishonorable discharge. So those different flavors of discharge, which I think at the end of the day, there's probably virtually zero difference in the impact on someone's life. It's very negative either way. But those different discharges are limited by the different, you know, corresponding courts martial that I just talked about, dishonorable being the worst of the two. But also, depending on the offense, every offense carries maximum punishments. And so the different types are, you know, what we call confinement, you know, which is jail time, reducing the person's rank from where they are now down to a certain level, and that's you know, given in the maximum punishment chart, as well as fines or forfeiting their pay or a portion of their pay for a certain period of months. So those are the most common punishments. It's, you know, it, oftentimes in the civilian world, you'll see people get probation that includes certain counseling or rehabilitative stuff. That's less common, I found. It's not specifically spelled out in the maximum punishment provisions under these articles. You'll see it sometimes with things like possession of child pornography, where they'll say, hey, we want you to take a class on, you know, kind of sex rehabilitation or what have you. But that's more common in the civilian world. You know, the ones I mentioned earlier are the typical, you know, meat and potatoes of every criminal case and every plea agreement.
Now, Alan, let me ask you. There is a recent reform that took effect to the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And if I'm not mistaken, it's technically called the 2016 reform, but it actually took effect here on January 1st of 2019. And I guess my question is, there's some things that I found that I thought were very interesting that don't exist in the civilian world. And I'd like to kind of just talk about, you know, from our perspective as military folk, how these things are impact or how they impact us. And the one I want to talk about is stolen valor. And I guess we'll start. I want to start with a story. There was, and I believe he was an admiral. And it was a couple of years ago. And at some point, he was, I mean, a serious military officer. He was a Navy SEAL, if I'm not mistaken, had seen combat multiple times. And somebody had noticed that he was wearing a Valor medal. And I guess I'm not sure how you all call it in the Navy, but there was some sort of medal that he had received for meritorious service and bravery. And in fact, he didn't have that medal. And when he was finally called out on it, he winds up committing suicide. And I guess let's talk for a second about why wearing a pin, literally a pin.
And for the people that are not in the military, stolen valor means wearing something, a medal or stripe or something on you that makes you seem more important than you are, that you didn't actually earn, right?
Right, and that's okay. Really what it is. It's not only necessarily something that you've done that's part of what you do as a job description, but it very well may also be a medal you've received for bravery or, you know, doing something beyond the call of duty. Why does the military take, you know, stolen valor so seriously?
Well, I tell you, it's for all the obvious reasons. Right, you know, oftentimes, you know, these medals and these awards are issued and get, you know, given for tremendous service of some kind, often, but not necessarily in combat situations, but often in combat situations where someone's exhibiting some amount of bravery or sacrifice, right? Mm-hmm. These things are really earned. In a different context, you know, you, in the military, you will receive awards at the end of your different tours. Like when I left my last position on active duty, I received what they call an end of tour award. Those awards are not something where you demonstrated, you know, bravery or valor in a common sense, but it's kind of oftentimes used socially to tell how long someone's been in the military, what their service was like. So, I mean, these are, you know, literally awards for good, great, or outstanding service, which may include, you know, in the combat zone where you're putting yourself at risk. And so, you know, here again, we see the unique culture of the military that is commanding a criminal provision to protect its culture, which is we don't want people to lie and misrepresent their service. In fact, my first tour as a defense attorney, I represented someone in the Coast Guard who'd been in over 20 years, and he was wearing a ribbon with two silver stars in it, which basically represented that he had received 11 of those awards. So the ribbon was one, each silver star represented five, right? So he was saying, I have 11 of these things. Well, he should have had two gold stars, which would have meant that he had three. A pretty big difference. And he got prosecuted for that.
So that's actually a crime? So this stolen valor is actually a crime? Like, can you go to jail for that?
I was going to say, people don't realize that. People go, not only do they go to jail for it, but, you know, they're dishonorably discharged sometimes for wearing decorations or medals that they're not, that they've not earned.
Yeah, potentially. And oftentimes I think these things go hand in hand with other things. Like in my case of that Coastie.
Was he getting paid more for those and things like that? Or is it just he...
He got promoted earlier, right? Because I think what happened, if memory serves in that case, is that there was some error in his record that he allowed to stay, right? You know, he basically turned a blind eye. And because his record illustrated that he had more awards than he really did, he was up for promotion earlier than he would have been under the Coast Guard's promotions thing. So he got promoted earlier, made more money earlier, and more in his career.
Yeah, see, that makes sense. That makes sense to me then.
Hey, Alan, let me ask, and for those of us that actually have served in the military, there are moments, and at least for me, I have moments that I remember like clear as day, and they're frankly, some of the best times I've ever had in my life. But a lot of funny stuff happens in the military. Is there anything that that sticks out to you during your service as a judge advocate general that happened that was just particularly memorable and funny?
Yeah, there are two that come to mind. You know, when I was my first tour, I was in Everett, Washington, and I was doing mostly criminal defense work. And when you're in that type of job, not only are you giving consultations for people who may be prosecuted in the military, which we've discussed, but also if somebody gets arrested out in town, right, they're going to have a civilian case. And I did a consult with a guy who came in and said, hey, you know, I was arrested yesterday. And I said, well, tell me what happened. And he says, well, you know, I work here. My wife works at Home Depot to help me make some money. And she had a night shift. So I went and met her for dinner during her dinner break. And then I was driving home. And you know, I was driving home naked. And I was like, whoop. Wait, hold on, what? And he goes, well, yeah, I was driving down, you know, I was driving down I-5 naked. I'm like, oh.
No big deal.
How come? and he looked at me, and he goes, well, I mean, you know. And I said, I'm sorry, I really don't know. Like, and he goes, well, I just really like to drive around naked. And I said, all right, well, good times. So then what happened? And he goes, well, I was driving on, you know, I-5, and I was right next to a school bus full of cheerleaders. And one of them must have gotten on their cell phones and called because, you know, a couple minutes later I got pulled over by the police for, you know, Washington State's version of lewd and lascivious behavior. And I always kind of wonder what happened to that guy. I've never met him again, but I can't imagine that went pretty well for him.
Well, see that story to me sounds like something that you would hear from your time representing people in Key West.
Yeah, you know, Key West, we didn't have a whole lot of misconduct, or still don't from the military. I'd say the most common thing that happens among military members are DUIs. You know.
Mm-hmm.
But a reoccurring theme, you know, most people don't know, you know, Key West is really an interesting military installation. You know, for starters, they have the premier air-to-air combat training facility in the military. But they also have a Special Forces underwater dive school that's operated by the Army. But they host all branches to go through that training. And one time I got a phone call from the port operations officers, the guy that operates a small little port, you know, that hosts vessels and different things. And he tells me that we have a French vessel in town, right? So we have a French ship that's doing some tour, the French military. They're in Key West for a couple of days. There's a Green Beret unit at the Army Underwater Dive School, and there's also a Navy SEAL unit at the Underwater Dive School. All three of these groups happen to meet, coincidentally, at Sloppy Joe's. And they figured out who each other was, and there was almost a brawl.
Oh, man.
And so my friend called me, and he's like, there is going to be a fight in the next 24 hours somewhere on this island. What are we going to do to make sure that these guys don't, you know, end their careers before they really get started? And so, you know, that's actually kind of a good illustration of sometimes when you're in that job as a JAG, is to try to, you know, protect people from themselves. And we had some meetings with the commanders to say, look, let's make sure our people don't, you know, let's protect them from themselves here.
Yeah.
So.
And that's another good illustration about how everybody kind of looks out for each other and, you know, you actually try to help people from committing crimes, as opposed to in civilian life. Sometimes it doesn't seem like that's what's always going on. But man, I really appreciate you coming on today and kind of giving us a little insight into military law and what JAGs do and giving us some of your story. So I really appreciate that, man.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. Bye-bye. And that's it from the real life Lieutenant Caffey. And no, he's not actually the guy that the movie's based off of. I was just making that joke. And I was thinking, you know, when somebody gets prosecuted criminally for not showing up to work, it's because you need them on that wall. I don't know how many times quotes from that movie were popping into my head during that interview. But thanks so much for listening in. As always, leave us some comments, some reviews, any topics you want to hear. All social media @TragosLaw. And we'll be back with you guys next time.